Hi, Lindsay, can you hear me? Great to meet you at last. How are you?
I am very, very well. How are you doing?
Really good. All the better for meeting you today. It's been an ambition of mine for some time.
Well, here we are.
Fantastic. I'm looking behind you, and how has the decluttering gone? What's the troubles for you of this?
It's basically the floor space is a lot better than it was. There's now a little more space to walk around. I wasn't getting rid of records or CDs. I mean, it's like, they're my research tools. Like,
Sacred turf.
I'm never going to get rid of them.
And you have a spouse who understands this. Now, I'm purposefully not panning the camera back, Lindsay. You can understand why. That the quagmire is very much a work in progress here. But I will learn from your most excellent skills in this department. Proof, I would say, that men can multitask.
I mean, I had a great time. I mean, while my wife was away in Jamaica, I had a great time. I'm not going to tell her that, but I had a great time while she was away in Jamaica. And it was very had a lot of peace and quiet and time to do things, and I really did a lot.
Now, there's a thing because you're both incredibly busy. She's got this crafts business going on. You two have worked together at various times, like running that stall in Petticoat Lane, as you recount in the book. It's been bloody hard work and pretty relentless, I would say. You seem to find joy in it still after quite a number of years.
Yeah, I mean that's a good point. I mean, I if I didn't enjoy it, I wouldn't do it. We have had a lot of fun. I mean, my mum always says that she always sees us laughing, and we're always laughing. Me and my long-suffering wife, we are always laughing, and we have a good time. I mean, we have been through a lot together, but we keep laughing. Yeah, we keep smiling, and we. Even if we have a crap time, we have a good time.
Well, you never would, I would say, and you spread the joy and the love of the music and everything else. I mean, you met through a band, didn't you? I was listening back to some of those tracks from Dazzle, sort of Rod Temperton two-step territory, right?
Yeah, I mean, back then it had a name. It had a they kind of created a genre in the UK, and they called it street soul, and
Yeah.
It was a UK thing, it was distinctively UK. And in the book, I kind of described that it had to work for two different scenes, really. It had to work for the soul scene, it had to work for the reggae scene. So it had to be quite functional music. It had to have the right tempo, and it had to work. 'Cause I mean, radio DJs, it didn't really exist. So, we were totally reliant on reggae club DJs and soul club DJs, and they were that was how you promoted music.
Of course, you became one. You became a record dealer, a record generator, a compiler to get Kiss FM going. You've worn so many hats in the music industry, very often, as I say, multitasking simultaneously.
I do multitask. I mean, in the we're not collecting rubbish. We're not kind of doing boring menial tasks. We're not stacking shelves at Sainsbury's. No disrespect to people who work at Sainsbury's, but it's like how in the music industry, how can you not have fun? How can you not enjoy yourself? When somebody says, do you want to do this? You just go, yeah, let's do it. It's like it's if it's in the music industry, it's going to be fun.
There's sort of a paradox here, isn't it? Because this book is very modestly entitled "The Mistakes I Made and How to Avoid Them," and I guess that's the book of every man and perhaps every woman to some extent. But you teach music, the practice of music production, being an artist, self-management at Point Blank and the London Contemporary School now. So, and you mentioned once or twice that some of the students aren't immediately perhaps able to cotton on to the combination of hard graft and the funky.
Well, I mean, this is students in general. I mean,
Yeah.
students have a reputation of enjoying their student life, and why shouldn't they?
Yeah.
Those are the golden years, and it's like, I mean, students in general, when they're at university, they have a good time, and And I mean, I'm talking to my students about the music industry and being a music artist. And I could say to them, hey, all the stuff I'm teaching you is important, but nothing's more important than your application and your endeavor and your hard work. Nothing's more important. And they would go, yeah, Lindsay, I get it, I get it, I get it. But they're students, and they want to go out drinking. They want to go out drinking. They want to go out chasing girls. It's
Yeah.
they are students.
As we did, I guess, yeah.
So I guess while I've got them, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, while I've got them, they'll be taking on a lot of knowledge, but they won't really appreciate the importance of really applying yourself and being disciplined and being professional. They kind of won't appreciate that for a while. I mean, after they've kind of, the novelty of being drunk has worn off, then they'll go, crikey, maybe I should start thinking about my career now.
I was going to say, it went back in the day, it was the necessity of being drunk at all those A&R parties and launch events and things, 24/7, right? Well, someone's got to do it.
Well, I mean, it's, I mean, this is kind of what I learned. My wife told me about, water cooler moments. She said, look, Lindsay, stop being so serious. Have a drink. Have fun conversations, and you'll get to the serious stuff later on. It's like, being sociable, being drunk, being sociable. I mean, that's how business gets done. It's like, and my students, I've said to them, networking is not a science, and getting a great record deal, you'd be surprised. I mean, it's probably going to happen at in a drunk moment at 4 in the morning. It's like
What a glorious thought.
that's when the best record deals get signed.
Yeah, traditionally that was very much the case, and I suspect much the better for it, as you imply, in terms of, your, I won't say hard yards, but your combination of hedonism and your bloody hard work and devotion to the craft and the good stuff. We talk a little bit about your dad? Because it seems to be you and he have a few things in common, if I may make so bold. First of all, being incredibly vocational and hitting the ground running, and having had these serial disappointments in life and occasional turnings that you might think better of, not many, but do you find his presence still in what you do now? And what did you make of what you ended up doing?
Well, I mean, I definitely wanted to follow in his footsteps. I mean, I was a great fan of his early work. I mean, his, the plays that really put him on the map. I mean, they are incredible pieces of theatre. I mean, they are amazing. The Kitchen, Chips with Everything, and Chicken Soup with Barley and Roots. I mean, these are amazing, amazing, amazing plays, and they'll be studied by students for centuries to come. So I definitely wanted to follow in his footsteps and try and write something memorable, something timeless. My thing is I just didn't want to do it the way he did it. I didn't want to go to that room. I didn't want to go to that room and hope that inspiration would arrive. So, I look like him, and I talk like him, and I behave like him, and there are so many similarities. And I echo his words all the time. I end up saying the same things to my kids that he said to me. I mean, similar in so many ways. It's just from my perspective, I haven't really written this amazing piece of work yet that people are going to want to study in schools. I'm not quite there yet.
Well, you say that modestly. You had this episode, didn't you, recently, with The Other Room, which is a play you wrote some time ago that got revived, and then you were sort of told what to do with it, to rewrite it.
Well, it was, I mean, it was, I mean, the situation with The Other Room was amazing. I mean, somehow I found the time to write a play. And it was incredibly well received, and we had momentum. We were doing rehearsed readings, and we had some momentum. But I mean, Yeah, I mean, the my in the incident with the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art, my incident with the dramaturg at RADA was just really, really bizarre. It's like I just it's hard to fathom how people can think like that. But I mean, yeah, I mean he's they did a rehearsed reading at RADA and it went very well, and then they started doing exercises with the students using my play. And at the end, the dramaturg invited me down to RADA and it's like, come and see what we're doing with your play. And they were the students and they were doing exercises. They had adopted the characters and they were improvising based on the characters. And I thought, well, wow, this is amazing. You know, I'm part of the RADA curriculum.
Well, lucky there.
And then all of a sudden, the dramaturg goes, what are your plans? What do you plan to do? I mean, surely, you should try and move this play forward and try and get it to more theatres. I said, yeah, that's definitely the plan. I definitely want to do that. And he said, yeah, well, in order for your play to be received, if you want it to be received more favourably, you should really have a diverse cast. And so I said, well, I when I write characters, I never kind of give them a color or a nationality. They're just characters. And he said, no, this will really, really work in your favor. If you have a diverse cast, your play will be received a lot more favorably. So I went, okay, well, I suppose I could go back to the characters and kind of attribute a nationality to them and maybe some kind of ethnic background. And he said, great, that's going to really help your play. And he said, okay, now that some of your characters are black, we should really create a racial storyline. We should kind of adapt your storyline so there's some kind of racial issue in your play. And I was like, there's no racial issue in my play. My characters aren't black. The only reason they've suddenly become black is because you said it might benefit the play if we make some of the characters, of a different nationality. And it was just the most bizarre situation. Why would you do that? I mean, it's like, do you like the play or not? It's like,
That's the bottom line, isn't it? I mean, a lot of people talk about I won't go down a rabbit hole here, but the Arts Council these days, ticking boxes and asking people to tick boxes rather than actually living the life, which is what you and Claudette and your glorious company do. You just know the turf as your dad did with Jewish culture, and you do. So I'm wondering if there might be sort of a bit of an analogy here with the way in which commerce addressed things like MTV Base and Kiss FM and everything else, and what happened there, and the fact that it seems to me, Lindsay, you are very deftly, with great ears, weaved between the commercial and suggesting what will be commercial, and as you say in the book, not my 80s, you were strictly underground.
yeah, I mean, I say to my students, I think it's really important to develop a kind of personal pair of ears and a kind of business pair of ears, because if you're kind of being asked to be an A&R person, you need to have those two pairs of ears. If you're being an A&R person, if you're choosing music for a radio station, choosing music for a TV station, if you're
Which you've done, admittedly.
curating a music festival, you need business ears and personal ears. And it's like you need to be able to say, well, look, this is an amazing piece of music, but it's a niche. It's not really going to have broad appeal. And then by the same token, you need to have these business ears and be able to say, well, look, it's these personal ears, and kind of say, well, look, it's terrible, I hate it, but the audience are going to love it, and I think it's going to make money. So this concept of business ears and personal ears, I mean, something I talk to my students about a lot, and it's kind of enabled me to do what I've done. I mean, it's like it helped me at Kiss, and it helped me be an A&R person, it helped me at MTV, having these two pairs of ears. And it's like, yeah, I mean, I just think that's an important thing. Even as a creative person, you need personal ears and business ears. You create a song and you kind of need to think to yourself, well, I love it, but is it a hit? It's like, should I kind of finish this and push it forward and mix it and release it? And it's like, or am I just being indulgent? It's like, And maybe you might sort of say, yeah, maybe I am being indulgent, but I love it. It's me. It represents me. I'm just going to go with it. It's not commercial, but I love it. I'm just going to go with it. You know, maybe you might make that decision. But you know, this concept of these two pairs of ears, I think is helpful for a creative person, and you know, a writer as well. You know, anybody writing TV scripts or plays or film scripts. It's like you know, you might love an idea and you might think, yeah, what an amazing idea. And then you've got to kind of go, but is it commercial? I mean, is it really going to make money? I mean, you know, it's like if it doesn't make money, it might my next project isn't going to be so warmly received.
Indeed, yeah. I mean, as a tastemaker, you've definitely pushed things into the mainstream. I suppose somebody less bitter and cynical, more bitter and cynical, might say that that there could be more profit in doing this. But very often, things like MTV Base were run in hindsight on your shoestring, weren't they? Obviously, Kiss FM for the love of it, you know.
Yeah, I mean, Kiss was a big business. It was kind of reliant on being a commercial success, and to a great degree, it was a commercial success.
Did very
But
well eventually, didn't he? Yes,
the
it did,
owners
yeah.
of the owners of Kiss didn't feel it was making enough money. I mean, it was making money, but they didn't feel it was making enough money. They wanted to make more money, so they threw all of us out and brought in some new people who kind of made the music policy very, very, very commercial, and eventually they were happy with the money they were making. I mean, yeah, we were making money, but we just weren't making enough for our owners. And when it came to Bass, I mean, Bass was initially just a music video channel, so it was just me and a PC, and there was, you know,
And
very,
a
very
porter
little.
cabin.
Yeah, literally to begin with, just a
Yeah.
porta cabin. So yeah, that was initially run on a shoestring. I mean, we did eventually make programs for the channel, but they didn't actually generate any great ratings. So it's like we didn't actually we invested money and it didn't actually, you know, increase the ratings.
The actual happenings at MTV Base have, if I may say so, a strong suggestion of your social engineering about them, in that people, famous and wannabes and whatnot, will wander in their best bib and tucker. It was kind of a happening in a way that some people might associate with the 60s, would ge presumably generating creative energy, generating the possibility of these hits, and the audience picking up on that vibe. Is that a concept that has potential revival, or is it the sort of thing that you find, say, in your student body now?
Well, I mean, it just so happens that MTV have relaunched one of their old music channels. I just saw this.
Have they now?
I just saw it online a few days ago, actually. MTV Dance became Club MTV, and they've just actually relaunched Club MTV. So, I mean, I don't know how that's going to work. I mean, I mean, YouTube just. I mean, who needs music television? It's like, you know, it's like you go to YouTube and within two clicks you're at your favorite video. I mean, this concept of sitting down on a sofa and watching music television and waiting and hoping your favorite music video is going to come along, I mean, it just seems like an antiquated idea. But that's how it was. I mean, you know, before YouTube, that's how it was. It was let's sit down on the sofa and watch music television and watch all of these videos and hopefully our favorite video will come on. I mean, that's how it used to be.
Yeah. So, again, your business ears are saying this, and they could well profit from listening to them, I guess. There is this heritage aspect to this music, isn't there? At the same time, my soul and the whole way you do your thing is all about getting people up on the floor. Presumably, your audience is now getting to be intergenerational. Do you find that? Do you look for
Yeah,
that?
I mean, we did the Brighton Weekender last weekend,
Fantastic.
and yeah, I mean the age range was 60s. I mean, there was one guy there; he was 80, all the way down to 20-year-olds. And I guess it's the kids coming through. You know, they love the disco vibe and the disco sound. So a fantastic age range, and. Yeah, they appreciate the old, and they appreciate everything. I mean, there's lots of I mean, the new stuff that we play invariably kind of has a retro feel to it. So a lot of the things on the My Soul playlist invariably have a kind of retro feel. But I mean, I mean, it's a community, it's a family. Everybody came together at Brighton over the weekend. It was, I mean, really great vibes. I mean, really great vibes. Playing pretty much everything, playing music from the 70s, right up to current day music. And but feel good music. I mean, it's called My Soul, and I know Gordon's emphasis is on, playing every style of music as long as it's soulful. I know that's his raison d'être. So. And that's what My Soul is. I mean, it's everything, but it's all very soulful, and it's all got a feel good feel to it. And you really felt that over the weekend. I mean, it was just everybody was just very just happy and smiling. I mean, it felt like a hippy dippy happening from the 60s, as you say. It really felt like a happening. We were like, it was far out, man. It really was.
Fantastic. What do you make of this retro feel coming into music? I hear it on some of the things that come my way on the shim, and I'm sure to you, Molly, first. The fact that technologically you can access so many ways of doing production, and through your bespoke ears, students can learn how to do it, get the feel of what this music is about. Does that imbue the present with something that it needs?
Well, I mean, the as the hip hop community found out, it's like it's difficult to resist those retro sounds and retro grooves. I mean, it's like when generating the first hip hop tunes, it was too good to resist, really. It was virtually impossible to resist. And I mean, we're now in a situation where it's a very producer-led music industry. So you've got these people, and they start out with laptops and screens and software. They start out on Ableton and Logic, and then they graduate to maybe some outboard gear and maybe a big desk at some stage. It's a very producer-orientated industry, and there's a real shortage of guitarists and bass players and drummers and percussionists, and they were the people who created the grooves back in the day. So there's a massive shortage of new original grooves, because there's no drummers, there's no bass players, there's no guitarists, there's no percussionists.
Is it the commercial scene? Sorry to interrupt you. Is it that the commercial scene doesn't dig the fact that you need to find these people
Well, I
and
mean,
pay them?
the grooves are being recreated by these producers. These
Right.
people with Ableton and Logic, they're kind of reproducing these grooves, and it's like invariably they're gonna. I mean, there's no, invariably they have to sample. Invariably they have to use some little archive sound. They have to use some little retro sound to give it a little bit of groove. I mean,
Oh, James Brown, all that De La Soul stuff, and
They're not drummers, they're not bass players, they're not guitarists, they're not percussionists. They are totally reliant on the past to give them that little groove. I mean, it's these producers, they're not musicians. They're not songwriters, they're not musicians. And it's like if you look at the way the Motown music was made in that little studio in Detroit. It's only a tiny studio, and they played those
Dodgy
songs live.
duffel coat and the bass drum.
Absolutely, or you've now got footage of the Beatles in Abbey Road, and it's like it was real musicians creating a groove. But let's bring Billy Preston into the studio to add some organ and piano. It's like amazing, we've
Fascinating.
got a groove, and it's like the modern producers, they invariably have to. I mean, there's no song in the top 40 that doesn't have a sample. It's got some little sample in there.
What's your take on that? I mean, I'm being the old fart here, very much not you. But having been all of these things yourself, Lindsay, from songwriter to producer to curator to DJ to producer, do you think that there's something missing in this mix? And if there is there a way to put it back?
Well, to my ears, there's something missing. But the 16-year-old kid doesn't know any better. So the 16-year-old kid is absolutely lapping it up, and it's like, the drum beat is very, very simplistic. Boom, bap, boom, bap, boom, bap, and it's like I'm used to shuffle. I'm used to Bernard Purdy, and it's like I'm used to Steve Gadd, and it's like the simplistic boom bap. I need a little bit more,
The
but they
physical
don't know any
presence, isn't
better.
it?
Yeah, they don't know any better, and it's like to them, it's a great drum beat, and that bass line that's just rooted to the bass note. It's like it's that's that to them is a great bass line.
There is a moment where musical cherries get popped. I mean, it had to you early on, didn't it? Can you see it happening to them? Simply by exposure to lots of good stuff?
I don't know. I don't know. I mean, a lot of the music a lot of the brand new music I hear, it sounds like ringtones. It sounds like the music from computer games. But that's what 13 and 14 and 15-year-olds grew up on. Those are the first pieces of music they heard. I mean, that to them is great music. And it's like, will it change? I don't think it will. I mean, people like me, we're going to die soon. It's like, it's gone. It'll be gone forever.
Nine lives, Lindsay. The thing is, you constantly reinvent stuff. I mean, what's on your bucket list now that you'd like to share?
I'm still trying to write, something really important, something really.
If not already.
Well, I mean, my father's plays are still taught in schools and drama schools, and I will feel I have achieved something when I can do that. That's really what I'm trying to do.
You strike me, you write, I would say, very much as a working journalist, which you started off as at Black Echoes and you founded various things over the years. What do you feel about the writing process now and actually getting a space to do it? I mean, you're in the den right now, but you lead an incredibly busy life. How do you nail that down?
Well, I mean, as I say, I wanted to follow in my dad's footsteps, but I didn't want to go to a room and hope for inspiration. So I think leading the busy life is important. It gives me inspiration. It gives me things to write about it. It gives me characters. So I think living the life I do is key to my writing process. I just think I need to get better. I mean, I'm a 65-year-old man, and I'm not long for this planet. But it's like I need to get better. I mean, I need to do better. I mean, I feel as though I've written some good things down the years. I'm proud of my novels. I'm proud of my plays. But I just giving myself a report card. I must try harder.
Well, that's very modestly put. I dare say Arnold, did Arnold have a look at your writing and at your music and your musical promotion in the early days? I'm just wondering what he made of it.
Well, I mean, he enjoyed my writing. He used to say to me, "I love the way you play with words," and I do. I mean, I do try to do that as much as possible. It's like, I try to create neologisms. I try and create my own words and my own phrases and my own ways of saying things. So I still try to play with words. But it's all about stories. It's all about stories and characters, and that's what I still appreciate. I mean, I finished last night. I finished watching something called The Residents, which is produced by Shonda Rhimes' Shondaland organization, And all of her stuff, you know, everything that she's involved in, she did Bridgerton, she did Scandal. Everything that she's involved in is really beautifully written. And yeah, I mean, I think that's what I'm aspiring to. You know, it's like I appreciate good stories, good characters, good dialogue. And that's what I need to do. That's what I appreciate. That's what I'm trying to do.
I have a notion I might have watched that episode of Angels that you wrote in the mid to late 70s, and I remember what a cracking series that was. And I think, as with everything you do, it takes you right into a world that you are glued to.
Yeah, I mean that was I mean Angels was you know kind of Casualty
Of its day, wasn't it?
decades before Casualty, and obviously all of the American shows that followed, you know, ER and Grey's Anatomy. It's like we have this fascination with doctors and nurses, and I mean that sounded dirty. I didn't mean it to be dirty.
It's inevitable, isn't it? But let's just leave it there. It's cool.
And yeah, I mean, I had to do a lot of research for it, but it was very enjoyable. And yeah, I mean, I'd love to do something like that again. But I mean, it has to fit within my multitasking life, you know.
Indeed. Well, they'd be very lucky to have you. And it's also refreshing to think that this television out there, I have to say, I haven't got one in the house at the moment. Maybe I should think again, because unlike some of commercial music, commercial television is still innovative with all the budget cuts and the concerns of the Hollywood unions at the moment and AI.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes people come up with really interesting ideas, and not overtly commercial ideas, but they just capture your imagination. I mean, something like Schitt's Creek, which was just so brilliant. I mean, quite a simple premise, but just so brilliant. I mean, it's the Levy guys just did a superb job. And great characters, great writing, great characters. It really, really worked. The Trouble and I at the moment are watching another thing called Hacks, which is really enjoyable. It's on Sky, and you know, it's about a famous female comedian who has always written her own jokes, but finally decides that she probably needs a little help. So she gets a
A Barry
TV.
Pirate, is it?
A TV, a TV comedy writer, and it's about their friendship, and it's very touching. It's very, very touching. Great story, great writing, great characters.
And one of those extant worlds where you have to get a battered old transit on the motorway and make 10 quid a night or something, as you did formerly in your sort of production life and your band life and your record promotion life.
Well, it's yeah, I mean, you've got to take the show on the road. I mean, whatever you are. I mean, if you're a musician, if you're a DJ, if you're a stand-up comedian, you've got to tread the boards. You've got to pay your dues.
It's a clarion call, Lindsay. This is a bloody marvellous book. Thank you very much for talking about it, for spending time with us. Real pleasure to meet you, sir.
Thank you. Thank you for the time.
Cheers for now.
Okay.